Welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. It's not just for contracting officers. If you're anywhere in the government acquisition world, this podcast is for you. Today's special guest, Troy Small, former Marine Corps contracting officer and current Skyway team member, joins Kevin to talk about standard operating procedures. Let's get started.
This episode is going to be fun. I'm joined by another one of our Skyway team members, a former contracting officer, Troy Small.
Hey, good morning, Kevin.
You're a retired Marine Corps contracting officer, and you've been on the Skyway team for 3 years. You got a really diverse background as a CO, in which we're going to go through some of the cool stuff you've done. But to kind of get us started, why don't you share some of your background?
I'm a retired United States Marine. I served 20 years in the Marine Corps as an active duty Marine. And for 15 years of my career, I was a contingency contracting officer. So that's where I got my experience in contracting. After retiring, I served 3 years as a consultant for a corporate entity, and then 6 years as a Navy program manager in San Diego. And for the past 3 years, we're going on four here soon, I've been with Skyway Acquisition as a team member.
Wow, man, time flies.
It does.
Well, and it's cool because you've got active duties contracting officer, you've got industry experience, and you even have Navy program manager. So yeah, we're tip of the iceberg, the kind of stuff we can talk about. Today, we're going to talk about standard operating procedures and how they impact government contracting. But first, I want to stop and say thanks. Thanks this week goes to Brian Blasser. Brian is a contracting officer at Navy Sea Systems Command. He's in the Washington, D.C. area. I want to thank Brian for liking and sharing our What is a Contract Vehicle episode. When our listeners share our episodes, it helps other people find our stuff and helps us continue to make government contracting better one contract at a time. So thank you, Brian, for liking and sharing our podcast. Okay, back to standard operating procedures. So walk us through how we got here, Troy.
Yeah, so how the topic of SOPs came up is one weekend I was binge watching firefights on YouTube.
Right? Marine, I love that.
Right. So I was watching OIF firefights with the Marines and Army. And, you know, I was focusing on their procedures and movement. And it just made me think that, you know, DOD is really a key user of SOPs. You know, as I was reflecting back on my Marine Corps infantry days, you know, I recall that we practiced various SOPs on a daily basis. I was an 0331 heavy machine gunner. I was stationed with 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines out of Hawaii, and I actually deployed to Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm with this unit. But SOPs were considered essential to mission accomplishment and the preservation of life and limb. For example, there is an SOP for when the warfighter is caught in an ambush. So if the enemy that is assaulting us is within hand grenade throwing range, then it's considered a near ambush. If the enemy is outside of hand grenade throwing range, then it is a far ambush. The standard operating procedures for a near ambush is to immediately return fire, seek cover, and then assault through the enemy ambush site. Basically, run towards the enemy fire.
Wow. I love talking to you because this is going to get the government contracting, but I love how just run into the fire. That's the standard operating procedure. Let's be clear. Okay.
Exactly.
So what about when it's a far ambush?
So for a far ambush, you know, to the contrary, the SOP is to return fire, seek cover, withdraw from the kill zone and or break contact. So in other words, move backwards, not forward. So two totally different responses or procedures for an ambush. So imagine, Kevin, how many SOPs are out there for other things.
And the beauty of this is there's a clear difference. Is the difference between the near and the far is hand grenade range. That's your variable that you're mapping around, right? And I love how we've taken this concept and applied it to government contracts because there's all kinds of variables in government contracting that drive you down one SOP or another.
So what are standard operating procedures? So SOPs are clearly written sets of instructions or methods detailing the procedures for carrying out a routine or reoccurring task or study.
That sounds like you read that out of a regulation.
I did, actually. So as an example, the U.S. Army Public Health Command, they wrote a technical guide entitled Writing and Managing a Standard Operating Procedure. And this guide actually highlights three uses of an SOP as an administrative tool. The first is that SOPs may be used to decide where in an organization a procedure should be carried out.
So in other words, an acquisition plan, an acquisition strategy, there's an SOP for that. So in the government contract land, there's a procedure that you got to know whether or not it applies. So that's the where to apply it in your organization. Like which contract type applies here? That's what we're talking about.
Exactly. And the second type of tool is that SOPs determine what material and personnel resources are required.
So now, okay. So now it's embedded in the SOP procedure, which is so funny to say, is who are the players? Is this the, who are the, of the three deciders? We talk about the three deciders in episode 118. Is the economic decider involved? Is the contracting officer involved? Is the customer involved? Like who is going to be involved in this SOP? And this can be frustrating if you don't know which contracting SOP applies to which person. Because if you're asking me to write, for example, the requirements document, as a contracting officer, I'm the wrong guy. It's not my SOP. But if you don't know that, then we're going to be talking past each other.
The third tool is that SOPs dictate the manner in which procedures are to be carried out. So, for example, instructions to offerors, right, are section L in an RFP. So this tells offerors or respondents how to respond, when to respond, and in what manner to respond, as an example.
What pops in my head is whether or not they're in hand grenade range. It's like you need to know what the variables are. That's why I love that example. It's so crystal clear, and it's not an example I would have thought to use. But yeah, in our conversation, it just came off as a perfect one.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, and so, you know, this kind of segues into, you know, why SOPs work. And one of the major key points is that, you know, SOPs establish operational procedures. They ensure continuity of operations and functions, and they provide a documented record of an organization's operating procedures during a specific time period. So for example, let's take a look at continuity of operations. The Marine Corps defines continuity of operations program as an organization's ability to continue its mission essential functions without unacceptable interruption before, during, and in the aftermath of a catastrophic event or emergency.
So in other words, something bad happens and the leadership intent is already understood so you can continue operations. Is that what you're saying?
That is absolutely what I'm saying. And thank you for using the word intent because within what we call COOP, there is...
Hang on. So COOP is continuity of operations plan.
Our program, yes.
Oh, okay, so yeah.
Some program,
COOP,
some
plan. That's awesome.
Exactly. Okay. So there's a lot out there about it. And so until this point, the commander's intent is the ultimate desire of the commander or the leader. And so, you know, we deal with, you know, industry and companies. We don't necessarily deal with the military units, but CEOs and presidents, they are officers of their company. And so by that, they are therefore commanders. And so they have commander's intent as well. And so this is very much applicable to the industry side.
So the commander's intent, that concept, is one of the reasons you have to have standard operating procedures, because that's how you implement the commander's intent. And so if you apply this to a government contract, if the contract intent, if the intent of the acquisition strategy, if the intent of the acquisition process isn't clear, we're going to be chasing our tails. One of the ways to make it clear is all of these standard operating procedures that are throughout the FAR. The processes that are built into all these acquisitions lead back to what is the intent of this contract, just like there's an intent of an organization. Or when we're working with our customers, what is the intent of bringing us on? What are we trying to accomplish together? There has to be that intent. Otherwise, we're just talking past each other and potentially treading water. Okay, so are we talking about technical, like the technical requirement and how the actual process works? Or are these more administrative tasks when we talk about SOPs?
So the use of SOPs may consist of technical or administrative tasks. So if, for example, the warfighter example. So the warfighter's immediate response to the near ambush, that was an example of a technical task within an SOP. Contracting tasks are not technical. They are administrative tasks.
True.
<right? yeah. laughs> So as an example, right? Like the DFARS has an SOP type of feel to it. For instance, the Berry Amendment is an SOP that is specific to the Department of Defense. Uniform Procurement Instrument Identifiers, right? Those are SOPs for the use of assigning PIDs. And PIDs, those are basically like solicitation numbers or contract numbers, the numbers with the letter and the year of the procurement in the contract number.
So just, this is fun. this proves the point of why SOPs are so important in context of government contracting. Just in those three bullets that you and I went over on our little slide here, there were one, let's see, DFARS is full of, the Defense FAR Acquisition Supplement is full of SOPs. And the Berry Amendment is one of them. Within the Berry Amendment, and by the way, I think we have a podcast we did with Shelley about the Berry Amendment. You have to manufacture certain things in the United States, et cetera. There's an entire process behind those. And then even the contract naming convention, which is what the PIDs are, there's an SOP for that. So there's so many SOPs that basically allows the process to work. Because without these, again, we're just guessing. It's like, imagine even a small company run without some kind of SOPs, you're just chasing your tail. And so it can be frustrating to think, why does the government have so many processes? And again, your story about the near and far ambush, it's like, that's why. Because if you don't know what to do in the moment, bad things can happen. That's an extreme example, but it still proves the point of why they're so important. So let's talk through where these apply in the acquisition time zone. We've been dropping little hints about where SOPs apply, but let's walk through the time zones and really show what this feels like.
So in the requirement zone, there is an SOP for the acquisition strategy and acquisition plan.
And those are in FAR Part 7, almost all of them.
The market research zone, there's an SOP for request for information, source of sought notices, the draft RFP responses.
Those are going to be in FAR Part 5, FAR Part 6, FAR Part 15. I mean, they're all over the place.
And that brings us to the RFP zone. So as an example, a request for a proposal, a request for quote, invitation for bid, they all have different procedures in how you respond to them and how those particular procurements are handled.
One could argue that a RFP effectively, this is going to sound really goofy, an RFP is effectively an SOP because it's giving you, this is the process we're going to use to award this contract. We've created our own standard operating procedure for how we're going to evaluate the winner of this contract. SOPs are everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, process equals procedures and vice versa, right? So even in the selection zone, we have SOPs. So there's the Source Selection Evaluation Board. So there's a procedure for how that team evaluates the proposals. Even the Source Selection Authority has a process involved with it. There are determinations and findings. There's JNAs, which basically are procedures.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even if it's a sole source contract, our 6.3 is where you find the SOP to how to write a JNA. Wow, that's an acronym soup. The standard operating procedures for how to write a justification and approval for a sole source contract are in FAR 6.3. But again, if you think of these as SOPs, it really helps you understand why government contracting feels so complicated.
I agree. I also think it probably maybe lights a fire to say, you know what, I should actually kind of look and see what these things say.
Yeah, there's that fact.
Exactly, right? You might get a hint there. Even the CPARS ratings and the CPARS process is a SOP.
Again, you think of the SOPs, why they exist, and it helps you embrace them more. I think it's a philosophical way to say it, just to be okay with how they seem like a lot of extra work, but they streamline everything in the long run. Okay, so we touched on the SOPs and where they fit in to FAR and a whole lot of other places, but why they're important, why they matter, why we care about them is they give context and they, I want to say facilitate, ensure, or even require communication. Because there's an SOP, like for example, CPARS, which Contractor Performance Assessment Reporting System. This is a basically a credit score for a government contractor on a particular contract. The SOP is the customer writes the review, gives it to industry, they get to look at it and concur or non-concur. That's part of the process. That's creating communication and it's giving the contractor context on what the government thought of their performance. So there's one small, tiny example of how an SOP provides context and communication.
SOPs help organizations to become more proactive and efficient in the management of their contracting efforts. And they also help everyone in the organization understand what tasks need to be done and how and when to do them.
So why does the government care about these SOPs other than the fact that, you know, there's a regulation that gives guidance on how to build them?
The government should care because if industry does not have context on what the government team is trying to do, this may result, you know, in a poor solicitation effort. The government could have a low response rate to the solicitation, and or they may have to, you know, do rework. You know, the government may have to either answer additional questions more so than normal. They may have to extend the project. They may even have to cancel a particular solicitation and resubmit it. Or God forbid, you know, they get a protest.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting point. One of the things that industry can protest is that the government didn't follow their process. Their process is an SOP. So these matter because industry gets to have an opinion on whether or not you followed your SOP. And that's a unique, I don't say it's unique to government, but it seems to be much more unique to government.
One of the things that, you know, or some of the things that government can do is, I think the first is to educate industry on which SOPs will apply, like which procedures will be in use for a particular situation. This can be done, like you were mentioning a short while ago, through communication and context. So for example, the acquisition plan will determine which SOP applies to a given situation. So some of these data points could be shared with industry, like some of these known instances can be provided to industry as a heads up so that industry can properly plan. And the reason why is because, you know, industry, they may not know that there even is an SOP in play.
Yeah, it's interesting. If I think of the times that I waited until I dropped the RFP, that I told everybody we were doing, for example, we're doing a small business set aside and a FAR 13.5 for a commercial item. There are three SOPs that are going to apply instantly as soon as I mention those things. Like, well, if I tell everybody that the day the RFP comes out versus a month earlier when we said, you know what, this is a commercial item, and you put that out as a notice of we intend to award this using commercial procedures. Right there, you told everybody, hey, FAR Part 15 and the long stuff, the all the cost data doesn't apply. All of those SOPs are off the table. Knowing that is huge for industry. And it also streamlines the overall process, but that's a different podcast episode.
Yeah. And you know, to the flip side, for the government, another concern or something that the government should be aware of is that government contractors have SOPs too. You know, so from my industry experience, there are a lot of SOPs on the industry side. For instance, there's capture process, bid strategy, PWIN, go, no-go decisions, win themes, sales, marketing, and many other procedures on the industry side.
Yeah, and it's funny that those are just the pre-award processes. I mean, keeping up with all the delivery processes and, you know, all the things that it takes to manage a contract after award, all of those are SOPs. And small companies and large have SOPs that, like you said, when you go to the industry side and you realize, oh, they have a process for this. Or a lot of the companies we work with, oh, you don't have a process for this? Let's build one. It's like, you know, it can be, and full disclosure, Skyway went through the same cycle. As we grew, we've had to create processes for things. And so it's important to understand from the government side that industry has their processes and they may take longer. Paul and I talk about getting something approved up the chain on the industry side during a negotiation can take just as long as it took to get it approved on the government side. And that's not something I really truly understood until we started working on the industry side. We now see it from both directions. That's a good segue to the industry side. But what should they be doing in context of SOPs?
One word I think is awareness from industry side, right? So, you know, I think that one of the first things that needs to be done is to identify, you know, which SOP frameworks the government could use in a given situation, and then determine which of those SOP frameworks the government is currently using, right? Because there's a difference between what could be done and what is currently being done. And I think the final one is that, you know, industry needs to assess which SOPs the government may use in the future.
Yeah, and that's a big part of what we help customers with is what could, one of my favorite questions to ask when we're helping folks build out their strategy, what do you want the acquisition strategy to be? Whether or not the government picks that strategy, that's a whole different conversation. But if you don't know the answer to that question, you're thoroughly in receive mode and it's not nearly as effective as being able to see what's going to happen or have a good idea what could happen. So on the government side, you got to realize that industry may not know that there's an SOP or a process for what you're doing. For the acquisition strategy you have has certain gates they have to go through. And I was often amazed that people don't know the SOPs that you and I took for granted. As a contracting officer, you had to go through these gates once you chose this acquisition strategy. And I felt like there were some folks in industry when I would be negotiating, they thought that some of these were optional and they're not. Bottom line is that mutual communication and understanding which SOPs are going to apply, which ones are optional, which ones are part of the decision tree for the government. That's the key factor here is that we both sides have to understand where these SOPs fit in. So thanks for joining me, Troy. This was fun.
It was. I'll see you tomorrow, Devin.
Okay, that's it for today's episode of the Contracting Officer Podcast. Thanks to our special guest, Troy Small. And thank you for joining us. When you need help understanding the government's standard operating procedures and which ones apply when and how, Skyway's team of former contracting officers, like Troy, can help. Visit skywayacq.com or give us a call at 877-884-5280. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.